You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Well, depend. Maybe you can troll, but you're going to control on your way to go somewhere where we're going to go bottom fishing. That's what we're going to be talking about a little bit today. Clay Tam from the PIFG is with us, and we're going to talk about some really interesting research that is way more, credible or it just counts so much more because of the manner in which this stuff is being done today. I think that we should, get into this a little bit with Clay. But first of all, I often mention all of the different stakeholders in the fishery when we talk about the council and all of the sideline players and the frontline players. And the PIFG, I don't think that any of these guys wanted to make another career out of what they do, but it's kind of turned out that way. And everybody wears a bunch of different hats. Clay Tam is, we're going to be calling him any number of things, all nice, as we get into this a little bit today. But before we get into actually talking, Clay, about the research project that we're going to talk about, let's talk a little bit about the early days of the PIFG. Who are you guys, for those that don't know?
Well, basically, PIFG is a nonprofit. It was formed because, like myself, I worked for and been part of agency for a number of years. And it really was to provide a conduit between agency and our fishing community. Being on both ends of the spectrum, there was a gap there, definitely. And
I think the good part about that is that everybody that gets into groups like that, and by the way, this is nonprofit by design. If you try to make a profit, it would be really tough. Nobody's making anything. A lot of people are putting a lot in there, but there must be some things that keep you going. And I think that maybe if people were to say, were asked you, I get it. You came from the agency, but what was the catalyst that brought all of these guys together?
I think commonality amongst all of the guys is the passion for fishing.
Yeah.
And being part of Hawaii, the culture, tradition, which is somewhat priceless. And
some people fish because they have to, right? Some people fish because they like to. Mm-hmm. And I think that most of us are both of the above. We love to fish, and we need to catch fish for one reason or another. And that's where I think that maybe a lot of people that don't understand that not every single person fishing is destroying the fishery. They're part of it, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. We're out there, and we're not only catching fish for ourselves, but to share. Mm-hmm. And the whole spirit of sharing is big.
We went through recently, and right now is this time of the year, as you know, is coming up on tsunami awareness season, and then we got hurricane season coming up. And every single one of us in the fishery always says, you know what? What if these airplanes can't come in here? What if these ships can't come in here? Do we even have the ability anymore to go out and catch our fish? Have that many people given up? Look at how many people used to bottom fish that don't anymore. It's kind of sad.
Yeah, it's true. A lot of the full-timers at Kuala Basin are now retired or out of the fishery. But I think that the newer generation can't exactly take the place in terms of commercial fishing, but definitely in terms of providing fish for the community.
There's another thing that we should talk about, and we'll talk about this as we go through the study and whatnot, is that there's an awful lot of fish that is caught and consumed that is below the radar. I do know that we're much more able to guesstimate it now than we used to be, based on fish stock assessments and some other things. But it's not that these people are doing anything unscrupulous or illegal. It's just that's kind of the way we are. Nobody broadcasts, I catch fish and I trade it for Manapua. But we do.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's growing up here like yourself, it's been a way of life. We provide, we share fishing. It's part of the opportunity, like was it hunting?
Same thing. Exactly. And that's why, and by the way, there's an awful lot of crossover between all these communities. But let's, one thing, there's another part of what we're talking about. When you're talking about just regular fish, pelagic game fish, or maybe, inshore fish, surround net fish, and that kind of thing, when you talk about, the favorite of many of you in your organization, the bottom fish, that's kind of the elusive ones. They're hard to find, and they are the highest value of the fish that we eat.
True.
Yeah.
And I think that's a mystique and a challenge of bottom fishing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are, which you can say, hooked on it.
Yeah.
And a lot of them spend a lot of time in that fishery.
Yeah, and it's all about passion. I can tell you one thing. I remember there was one store when I was a small kid. It's now where Kahala Mall is. It was called K. Okada Store. And one thing that they always had was whatever the hardest to find fish, they had it. And I remember as a little boy, not knowing, I've never ever saw one in all my inshore fishing was Nabeta. And they used to be able to buy Nabeta in a store every now and again. But today's Nabeta, if it ever shows up in a market, it's a rarity, right? But if you're the Nabeta guy, and I know it, I'm going to save something for you. You're going to get a bottle of my best stuff or something because you're going to give me a Nabeta, you know?
That is true. Yeah. That is true. There are treasures in the ocean like that. Yeah. And for us that, you know, catch it and also consume it, I think the value is something priceless.
I remember one time talking to, I think it was Harry Kojima years ago, and they went out with a guy that was catching Nabeta, and it was like 20 minutes of catching one Nabeta after another. And you would have thought that it would have been the most boring show there is, but it was one of the more popular ones because just showing what effort had to be made to go out and get that particular fish was pretty amazing. And when you could catch them, it was amazing how many you could catch. So what when you talk about the other side of things, when you got together recently and some of the studies and the opinions that you profile, what is the moving, what's the motivator behind it? Like, for instance, the thing that we're going to talk about a little bit today is this, the cooperative research that's done. Who decides what gets done? I know that you guys with tagging projects, what is the aim of that? Why do we want to keep a record of fish and tag them?
Well, the important part is with the stock assessment is doing the science. Collecting the data is important.
Mm-hmm.
But with PFG, the importance is we try to have fishermen be part of the solution, not the problem. And no better else than have a fisherman catch fish.
Yeah, that's really true. As a matter of fact, the last Fishers Forum, which, by the way, was a big departure on what we've normally done. We had me and other members of the media sitting there trying to ask the fishermen, what do you want to hear and who do you believe and what are these stories are true and how are they tainted? It got to me to be a point where we said, all right, if we have this group, this bottom fishing group, and that's what I want to swing the conversation to a little bit, is that we need to make sure that nobody is accused of doing something illegal or immoral. And most of these guys are not, right, as far as where they fish. Do you look at the research that's been done and some of the things that we're going to talk about being a way to open up some of the areas that have been closed? Maybe there are some areas that shouldn't have been closed.
Yeah, this is a good possibility, and the data indicates that. Mm-hmm. The buffers are set up for a purpose, and that purpose has now been somewhat outdated and fulfilled based on the current assessment.
Yeah.
So, why have it if it's outserved its purpose?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I mean, most of the people that are good at this, and we talked off the air, and we can certainly talk on the air about it. There's not as many people relying on their expertise anymore to go out and really make a day of bottom fishing. There's, as a matter of fact, on Oahu, I only know of a couple of handfuls of guys that really know what they're doing and could actually make part of or all their living bottom fishing. It's pretty tough, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's a tough fishery. Yeah, and like you said, you got to be passionate about it. If not, it's like your work. Unless you're passionate about it, it's difficult.
Yeah, and like I said, it's neat when you get to go fishing, but it's harder when you have to go fishing. But what is the mystique about that this deep seven that it makes them so intriguing? Outside of their taste, obviously, because they're good fish.
Oh, yeah. I think for fishermen, it's the hunt. To be successful, you have to understand all the elements, current, tide, and it's always changing.
Most of us don't know what effort is.
Right.
And this is one of the things that has come up in some of the more in the research now. It used to be that you used to have to plan your catch. It was based on, how many hours you're away from the boat ramp, right? Mm-hmm. Or whatever. Right. Now, to be honest, in these assessments, your travel time to wherever you're fishing is not important. But it is if you're the guy paying for the fuel. You know, and wanting to go all those miles out to catch. So what are the parameters on this recent group of studies on bottom fishing? What were the parameters? What were you looking to quantify or to identify?
Well, the basis was based on CPUE, catch per unit effort. And so in order to calibrate and standardize across the different fishermen that we worked with, they had to be certain number of hooks, certain kind of bait, so much time in certain areas and so forth to quantify it and make it where they can be used in a stock assessment.
Okay, now, and I know the jury's out, but there's been a dramatic change in the way you can buy bait. I mean, and lures. I remember when damashis were all made by hand. Somebody made them. And then they came to be able to be mass producing them. And then they got to a point where a guy could put 20 of them on one line and then wait for to get the whole thing loaded up. Are those considerations within the study, the type of gear or the type of bait?
Oh, definitely type of bait. Mm-hmm. We use two types of bait, a squid and a fish bait. Right. And that's up to the captains on as far as fish bait. But we know there is a preference and difference, and they've been trying to tease that out of the data, and it's showing for certain species like yahoo and naga, as we know.
Is it sort of amazing that sometimes when you're fishing for a species that's all you see? For some reason, either your bait or the method, other bycatch don't get involved that much. I mean, is that true? Because that's what happens to us sometimes.
No, that's true. I mean, like having your favorite or right lure in the water that catches mahi-mahis usually.
Yeah,
won't catch a high in Ireland, but it's going to catch.
It's amazing.
If there's a mahi-mahi tournament, I'm going to run that lure. But yes,
I got this guy that is so good on bottom fishing. And when he says, let's go catch this or let's go catch that, that's what he catches. And I've always respected that, because I can remember back in the day when I first learned about it, I just thought you picked the place where there was likely to be fish. None of us had fish finders. Nobody had locations. You just picked the place where the second tree on the ridge lined up with the top of the ridge, and that's where you caught, and that's where you're going to get an onaga. But today, it's a lot different. And I think maybe it's because some people don't know how these assessments are done, particularly in deep water. How do you go about doing that?
Well, you know, the main focus and framework of that is designed by scientists who work with the stock assessment. But the actual fishing that fishermen do is trying to match that, where they can come up with, you know, some number.
Mm-hmm.
And then getting there is part of the...
For those that don't know, mm-hmm. who are the ones that set the limits and set the parameters and decide what areas are closed or open?
From the closed areas, the buffers were established by state.
Mm-hmm. By DLNR.
DLNR, right. And, you know, most of them were in state waters, so they had control of the waters. And they both overlap in with the federals in terms of management of the deep seven species. So there's this co-management of the species. That's where there's two different types of management comes in, stock assessment and the buffers. So it is
one thing that I always got a kick out of. There's some people that I know that know seasonally what fish are in season. And just because you're part of that deep seven doesn't mean you can go catch all seven of those species all year round. Isn't it true that some of the fishermen, they will switch from one species to another depending on the season, because they know that that's what they can get and that's what the market will accept?
No, that's true. And on any given day, which one will be biting? Mm-hmm. That's the question.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no, and maybe if you could explain, people, if you heard Clay earlier, he talked about effort. And this is something that a lot of us don't consider. We just think an effort is getting out of bed and going fishing. But what comprises the lines of demarcation in a study like this? When you talk about effort, what does that mean?
Effort is basically a unit of measured time in conjunction with the gear used.
Mm-hmm.
So number of hook hours, depth and range and what fishery you're in and what your target species may be.
But relying on the, like in your group, it's terrific. But we're relying on somebody understanding how to get that data, how to be accurate with it. Don't make up stuff. Don't minus stuff. In other words, be kind of truthful, because in the end run, sometimes the larger the number that is reported is better for the limit. I mean, I don't understand how that works, but from what I understand, it does work that way.
Yeah, it does work that way. And you know, keep the bias on an even keel, so to speak. We do have trained observers by NOAA staff and they're trained in species ID measurement and certain elements that need to be recorded. Mm-hmm. And so they're... replace those on the boats with fishermen. So there's less bias in terms of data and there's more structure and standardization.
Gang, if you go to fishtoday.org, you're going to see some of the stuff that Clay and I are talking about. And one of the things that I've always admired about them is I remember the first time I saw a poster, which is on the website and reminded me of it. It was the Hawaii Bottom Fish Tagging Project. And it said, got tags, get shirt. Now, some people tag them, right? Which is a pretty generous thing to do because some people would just keep it, but some people understand the need for this tagging. But what about when you catch a fish that's got a tag in it?
Yeah, if you catch a fish, it's all the more valuable. In fact, you know, we went for a number of years of tagging, supported through Science Center. We worked with commercial, a couple of recreational fishermen to do it. There was some compensation because of the value of the fishery.
Yeah.
But the important part was that if you do catch one, if you can, please report our phone number, our emails on the tag number. So we need fork length measurement, species, depth range, location of where it was caught, so we can figure out where the fish was, yeah, might have traveled, and days of liberty, which is important because we're learning that, and we found through previous tagging projects that paka actually swim between islands.
Yeah, and this is something really important, my friends, because there was always this bridge that was trying to be made saying that the Papahana Mokuakea monument was a nursery for fish that were being caught off of the main Hawaiian islands. There's never been able to substantiate that with all species, but one of the things that Clay just said, and it's important that you understand this, if you expect that a fish can't go a far distance, you're wrong, because these fish that go between island to island, sometime the area they're traversing is bottomless, especially for them, right? So it must show something's going on in that fish to make him know that he's got to go over there.
Right. Well, definitely. And if you look at the tagging validates some of the DNA work that's been going mm-hmm. on, showing that it's one unique stock and that they are traveling and intermixing in terms of spawning. And that goes back now to management. So if you have areas that are where you're like the buffers where there's not a lot of fish, but the fish are moving, perhaps a different type of management would be better applied to that fishery. Being that they're moving in and out, because the cold air is not going to benefit them.
That's really interesting. And I do know that we could set aside hours and give out anecdotal stories, but I know that even some of the most scientific of you all are amazed at where some of these fish got caught as to far where they were tagged. I mean, if you're talking about a opakapaka, which is a small little pink snapper, for that thing to travel great distances says a lot about the species, but also maybe about the quantity.
That's true, and that's why fishermen, when they go to areas, the fish may or may not be there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not maybe they think it may not be biting, but with today's equipment, you can more or less tell if the fish are there. But if they're not there, where did they go?
It's very interesting to me because that's what people will say, oh, that whole area is fished out, so let's close it. And in many respects, in some areas, it was probably true. I mean, I don't know about you, but it always disturbs me on the odd and even years at Waikiki. Because it takes that reef or that area about a year to recover, and then it gets kind of hammered in one day because people want to go out and do that. But isn't that part of the learning experience that, you know, the area that's closed, the area immediately adjacent to it may have plenty of fish?
That's true.
You know, fish don't see the boundaries under the water, right? They don't know they're going from one grid to the other.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the fish have no boundaries. There's no walls in the water. Yeah. So, you know, they're going to go where they need to go.
What do you see coming out of the latest research that you folks have been able to produce? First of all, let's let people know what it was. And second of all, what it's going to be used for. Because from what I understand, and the reason why we thought it would be key to invite you, and if you're just joining us, Clay Tam is with a group that's been making a very interesting study for a while. And you go to fishtoday.org and learn about them. It is, to me, almost like a Bible, almost like a guide. So talk about that a little bit, what PIFG does with this study. Who's the intended recipient?
Well, it's about the fishery and the fishermen in the fishery, and that's what makes it important. And, you know, we've worked with highline fishermen in the fishery who...
Sorry.
Yeah. By the way, this is strictly a local study. I mean, they incorporate methodology from other areas, but this particular study is directly connected to either being open for fishing, closed for fishing, regulated, size regulated, species regulated. And that's why this is valuable stuff. So once again, how many people were involved in it?
Roughly, in the ongoing survey itself, fisherman-wise, there's six boats that are involved. There's a seventh boat that's on backup. There's also equal number of observers on board, and so captain and crew plus observer.
Yeah, very interesting stuff. And by the way, these are the guys that were have been recently affected by some of the legislation to, or some of the rules being made to license and how many fishermen are on your boat and everything. It looks like they're giving you guys an awful lot of work to do sometimes.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, but the fishermen that are participating truly, a lot of them are full-time fishermen. Mm-hmm. So they're actually truly stakeholders in a fishery, which is good to see that they become part of the process.
You know, when somebody's coming up the chain to take over for dad or uncle, if the outgoing fisherman or the retiring fisherman is negative, that's going to be another loss for us. And I do know that a lot of these people, and I'm kind of one of them, in some respects started resenting some of the controls being put on the fishery by people that either are not familiar with the fishery or just don't even fish. So maybe this information is going to help in the decision-making process.
Oh, definitely. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's already changed the numbers in the terms of assessment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a better number than what they had before using catch report information.
And since when you started and when some of the other guys started, I know we're all amazed at improvements in detecting devices in our fish finders, in the lines and the reels and the gear, in the lures, everything. If anything, the fish, you would think there would be no fish. You'd think we got so good we caught them all, but it doesn't seem to be the case.
That's true. Yeah. Fish will be fish.
Yeah.
And on any given day, if they're not going to bite, they're not going to bite. Yeah. In this case, it's a strictly hook and line fishery. So they won't be trapped. They won't be trawled. They're not going
to
be caught.
Yeah, and that's the other side of it. You have to differentiate between that. So obviously, those that are in the fishery understand that the only way you can make a good decision is getting as much information together. That's why I asked you, of these six boats, most of them know what they're doing. They're going to prime locations. I mean, they're going to where the fish should be to make the study.
Yeah, to keep the sites random, they're randomly drawn through Science Center to give it, even if you don't catch, it's important, and also catching. So there's they go through and do it with the assessment. Yeah.
You know, you mentioned earlier fork length, and a lot of people didn't understand what that was. So I know that a lot of people are watching Wicked Tuna now because this is the time of the year for it, right? And they have a 73-inch minimum. So and they call it a short. And they can see it. It's coming up to the boat. I had Captain Dave Marciano on the program 2 weeks ago. And he said, you can see the fish coming up. It's not just the way it's acting, but you can actually, after experience, now it's short, let it go. And when they catch one that's acceptable, sometimes it's only long by 1 inch or 2 inches. But so that measurement is where? The fork length. Where do you measure from?
Generally from the nose to the V in the tail.
Right.
Yep.
And now, obviously, they call, sometimes in the bluefin tuna, they call it a butterball when it's fatter. Mm-hmm. Can it be a difference? You know, I mean, sometimes if you put out your tape and it's 73 inches, if it's a fatty, it might be only 70 inches or 76 inches or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Because it goes up higher.
That's true. Generally, for application-wise, when you do tagging, it's measured on a flat board. So it's from those that bottoms out on zero and the fork, the V on a ruler. And
Which is a lot more accurate, right?
Correct.
So now, on any given time, for instance, for this recent study, are we talking about lots and lots of fish being measured and tagged?
Every fish caught is measured, except all of the deep seven, even some of the non-deep seven. Well, sharks in the dangerous if you don't measure. Of course, we let those go as eels and stuff.
But
generally, every fish is identified, measured, and in this case, for deep seven, they're tagged and put on ice, and then they're return to Science Center for life history studies.
Yeah.
Yep. Gonads, and they'll look at otoliths, aging.
Yeah. And that's another interesting thing, right? I mean, everybody wants the big ones. Some of these fish don't get that big, and they last for, I mean, they live sometimes a pretty long time. I'm amazed at what some of the studies have shown, that you can have a fish that's many years old. It's shocking. You know, I mean, and yet all I want to do is catch that bugger and eat it. You know, and even though it hasn't changed a lot. And are there also other misconceptions about the deep seven as to how deep they are? Aren't they all they're not all at the same depth. I mean, there's some fish that you can catch in shallower water. Some fish you got to go deeper.
Yeah, you're true. That's right. Mm-hmm. And they all have a preference like us mm-hmm. in terms of temperature and where we live and where we go. Yeah, same thing. Yeah.
It's how did they become to know that? Is it just market value or where you catch them that matters that calls it a deep seven fish?
I guess it's been, yeah, probably by depth zone and the type of fish that are in those areas.
What's amazing to me, Clay, and I'm sure you've heard this before, is that how in the world did we ever figure out, you know, where these were in the first place? Because there's no indication in old Hawaii that the fish were caught in deep water. You know, I'm sure it was for some. But, I mean, the snappers, for instance, when I was a kid, you almost never saw an opa, you know, in the market. And now we go catch opa, and it's not that far away. So that must mean it's the gear and the knowledge that depends on how the fish gets caught.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, back in the day when we did the Bottlefish Heritage Series mm-hmm. with the old-time bottlefishermen, and hear the stories about when they fish with no depth recorder, they mm-hmm. throw the line over, and if it bottom, that was bottom.
That's about
and then what they caught there. And then, you know, you listen to the guys that learned from the old-timers, and their job was to go and drop the line mm-hmm. and find the bottom
yeah.
and pull it up by hand if they didn't catch.
It was
a painful process.
Yeah, but amen.
Thank goodness with today's technology, as you said, it's improved somewhat, but you still have to go and do the fishing.
Well, you know, I spent some time, and I'm sure you have too, with the Ikishibi guys off the Big Island. And when you talk about backbreaking work, that is backbreaking work because that's all by hand, you know. They got a basket full of line and some arms to pull it up. But I think at the end run, it must be a tip of the hat, and I know that you can do this too, to thank each and every person that bothers to get involved and participate, not just only in these assessments, but in the reality and the truth in reporting. Because it used to be, tell me you're not guilty of this. I know I was, and I admitted it years ago. I used to get my commercial, my catch book, when it had the carbon paper in it, and just put no fishing. And I didn't realize what a disservice that was until later on. Because if you say you don't catch any fish, you're not going to be a lot. You're not going to get an allotment for a fish. If you catch, you know what I'm getting at? Are we being more honest with this reporting? I think so.
I think more so today than ever before, especially with all the management tools there. When we talk about turning in a did not fish catch, that could mean in future that you may not have a quota if it goes to a quota system. Or, you know, audit information is possible. We all have responsibilities in terms of managing our resource, and that's one way a fisherman can help.
Where do the fruits in your labor go now? Now that you've completed this last batch of research, what's next?
I don't know. There's a lot of opportunity out there. Mm-hmm. Science has changed. There's mm-hmm. been a lot of different techniques applied, even for aging. As you talked about bottlefish aging, Paka on conventional otolith reed was, you know, said to be 25 years old, but not with radio bomb carbon dating. Now they push it up to 40 years old.
It's amazing.
So, there's so many new tools now. Mm-hmm. It's going to rewrite a lot of science.
Mm-hmm.
And so for us, it's moving down that road.
I was watching a documentary a couple of months ago on the Galapagos and some other islands. And when these little babies, these turtles particularly, there's literally thousands and thousands of them, but there's predators waiting right in the water where they go in the water. And it's doggone amazing that any of them make it, you know. And when they finally do make it, they come back to that beach later to do their own spawning. And yet now some days, because they're talking about the global warming and all of that stuff, they go back to where they thought, and there's where they were is gone. And I'm worried that that's not going to happen here someday. So, like I said again, I want to make sure that people understand when they either participate in this research or when a project is completed, it goes up the chain to the next person who's going to be able to assess what you've come up with and make decisions that we all live by.
That's true, Mike. Mm-hmm. And then moving down the road, an analogy would be like planting that mango tree.
Mm-hmm.
10 years later, you reap the fruits when it starts fruiting.
And that's a great analogy because I can tell you the same thing with avocado or anything else. You know, and it's like one guy told me, and I learned a lesson from this. And when you talk about aging, there was this guy that he's part of the shrimp farms out in Kahuku a long time ago. His name was Lyndon Brazell. He was a scientist. He also had, he and his wife, up in the back of Waimanalo, they had a place where they tended for and healed wounded exotic birds. And they would adopt them out, these parrots and these things. And one of the things they would ask you is, if let's say you're going to go out and the parrot is, who are you going to leave this to? because it's going to outlive you. These birds live to be 70, 80 years old. And if you're 40 and you adopt a parrot, you got to have somewhere to go with it. Isn't that amazing? You catch a fish and you bring it home and you cook it for your family, and that fish might be 40 or 50 years old.
Yep, interesting.
I'm amazed at that.
Totally amazing. It's probably older than some of the people consuming it.
Exactly. You know, and we call it fresh, you know. Yeah. I mean, but I think at the end of the day, we should acknowledge not just you, Clay, everybody in the organization, because I know this is all extra work, and sometimes it's pretty frustrating. And like we say in Hawaii, it's all kill fight. I don't want to do that because it's going to come back and bite me. But it looks to me like, aren't there some decisions being made right now about the protected areas and about quantities and allotments?
That's true. Quotas? Yeah, it's always been part of the mandate in the fisheries management is to find that magic number.
Yeah.
Or the right tool to manage the fisheries, and that's why it's always changing. And that's where I think that the more data they have, it's important for the guys. Some, you know, the old school guys may not think so, but today's management is quite different. I mean, back in the day, we used to go throw a line from the beach and not worry about it. But today, if you don't get involved with some of the politics or issues, you're not going to be able to throw that line tomorrow.
And there's no beach left.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
There's too many people in the water that didn't get hooked. But that's another thing I learned from the Outer Banks guys and Wicked Tuna guys, and that is that they're religious to their closing date. When that fish gets caught, it's over. And they know it and they expect it. And the other thing that I was, and I'm not sure this would happen here, when you start talking the difference in an ahi of an inch, when you're talking 70 inches or 73 inches, that many people wouldn't just take the short. But there are consequences back there if you do that. I mean, serious consequences, right? And someday that's going to be here. One more thing, even though it wasn't to do with what we were talking about, in some respects it was. It doesn't look like this year's legislature is going to go forward with the licensing of non-commercial fishery. And I do know that there's a lot of mixed emotion in the fishery about it, depending on where the money would go. But doesn't that show that there is reluctance on the behalf of lawmakers to upset the apple cart if the apple cart doesn't look like it was going to topple over?
Yeah, I think that's true. There's two sides of the story, as you say, and I think that's an important part, is that that be discussed on a broader level and not something done in a few days at the square building. It should be, if it's going to do it right. Go out to the community, talk to the fishermen, talk to those guys out there and get a real feel of where it needs to
be. You know, one guy said to me, he says, hey, you know what you got to talk about? Talk about turtles. How many turtles are out there now? When are we going to be able to eat turtle again? You know, and I know that there's a lot of people, me included, that I used to have a turtle cat tag. I would do it again, but it's only personal experience that tells us now. I know when you guys are going in and out the channels, you see the same turtles that we do. There's turtles. And that shows that if you close something, Mother Nature will repair it. But maybe there's some people saying, but these bottom fishing areas that have been closed, all they're doing now is feeding the predators. There's plenty of fish there. We got to be able to go out and eat some of those. Is that a fair assessment?
I think so. There's a lot of opinion on that too. But generally, yeah. I mean, but when you look at the assessment, it was based on all areas being open, not closed.
Yep.
So to put it on the same playing field, I think, you know, having it open, in my personal opinion, would be beneficial. I mean, if you look at a big closure, you look up the Northwest, we lost 75% of our grounds.
That's 50%
of our bottom fish catch in Hawaii.
Yeah.
And that's a lot.
There's something really, really bad with that, because you know who's going to pay for that is the guy that goes to the market to buy that fish, because it's not going to be there, or it's going to be there from somewhere else, and it's going to cost way more money. And we already know that a lot of us don't trust fish that comes from somewhere else.
That's true, Mike. And I think the big thing is that what do we have here and where do we go? We talk about food security, stuff like that. And, you know, that fishery up in the Northwest was a local fishery.
Yeah, and by the way, that being said, wasn't it also true in the original monument? There was only less than a dozen guys still fishing up there anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, what kind of an impact could they have had on the fishery, right?
Definitely. And there was all kinds of accusations about them impacting monk seals and all that. But they had observers on board for a whole year, not one.
Yeah. Yeah, and the interesting thing about the monk seal is they're doing better on Waikiki Beach than they are over there, right? There's too many apex predators for them. Interesting stuff. Always good fun to hook up with you guys, Clay. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. Okay, when we come back next week, we're going to get back into some of the other things that happened at the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management council series of meetings and talk about this some more. We're going to get into this some more. Got to get that bottom fish. You want to know more about Clay's Gang, go to www.fishtoday.org. Fishtoday.org. A lot of good stuff on there. And if you want to hear something on the program, you know what to do. Drop me a line. TheMikeBuckShow@gmail.com. TheMikeBuckShow@gmail.com. Have a great Easter. Rest of your weekend. Go out and catch some fish and eat them and share them. And if you got any left over, TheMikeBuckShow@gmail.com. I'll come pick it up. You can even leave the bones in it. Hey, thanks for listening. See you next time. Aloha. Se lo lleva la chiflada, la cucaracha, la cucaracha.